Throughout history, public portrayals of African-American women have repeatedly fallen into certain stereotypes. Today, we'll talk about how that's changing. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Lakeisha Johnson. She's an assistant professor of gender, women's and sexuality studies and English at Grinnell College. Her latest book is Iconic, Decoding Images of the Revolutionary Black Woman. We'll talk about how black women have been portrayed in the past, contemporary efforts to pigeonhole black women in the media, and women who have and are continuing to break through the stereotypes. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Certain images of African-American women have popped up repeatedly throughout our history. Images of black women as nurturers, the mammy idea. Images of black women as sexual objects and black women as angry and dangerous. Today, we're going to talk about these portrayals, some of the women who've been tarnished by them, the women who have broken through, and how African-American women are being portrayed today. My guest is Lakeisha Johnson. She's an assistant professor of gender, women's and sexuality studies and English at Grinnell College. Her latest book is Iconic, Decoding Images of the Revolutionary Black Woman. Hi, Lakeisha.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for coming in today. And let's talk about some of these stereotypes and the ways that we've seen them pop up in media, in popular culture, in newspapers, in magazines throughout history. And let's start with that, the mammy portrayal of black women. We started seeing that a long time ago.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and one of the most famous portrayals of mammy would be Hattie McDaniel's in Gone with the Wind, right? It's a cherished image in American popular culture that is of this heavy, dark black woman who nurtures the family in which she's working, right? So sometimes and many times at the expense of sort of her own family. And so I think, and I mean, one could say, well, that's sort of connected to Southern culture when you think about Gone with the Wind, but I think it's also, it's permeated American culture. So we're, you know, we know who Mammy is. Her sister, her cousin is Aunt Jemima, right? So we, you know, we see her on the pancake box. So she's there in many different ways.
Well, and you think about sitcoms. This is an image that pops up repeatedly still.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned sitcoms because I remember when I was younger watching Give Me a Break with Nell Carter. And I actually loved that show. I was a kid, but my grandfather was always so upset by it. And I think one of the problems that he had with it is that he felt that she was, again, hearkening to this representation of, you know, the African-American woman as servant. But then she was also the source of entertainment for the family, for the viewer.
Right. And she really didn't have a life outside of that family.
Exactly. Exactly.
The sexual object idea, that's a pretty easy one to grasp, and I'm sure there are images that come to mind for all of us.
Oh, yeah.
When you think about that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the sexualization of women in popular culture is not, you know, limited to black women, obviously. But I do think one of the things that I talk about in the book is the way in which the sexualization of black women in various forms of popular culture is a way to ameliorate anxieties about the power of black women. And if you think about the fact that, you know, we're inundated with these images of angry black women, then how does the society deal with that? You know, and one way to deal with that is to sexualize them, right? To think of them as less threatening because they're available sexually. I mean, that's one way to do it. Obviously, you know, there are other ways as well.
And I want to really dig into this angry black woman stereotype. That's something you spend the most amount of time on in the book. But before we dig into that, I want to talk about Sojourner Truth, because you start with image work way back. Mm-hmm. And for people who are not familiar with her story, give us just a thumbnail sketch of who Sojourner Truth was.
Wow. Sojourner Truth, one of the most important African-American women in terms of the fight to end slavery. I mean, she herself was enslaved. Was able to gain her freedom and actually even fought in court for the freedom of her child. A lot of people don't know that. And one of the reasons why I picked her, I mean, there are a lot of other women that I could have, you know, started with, like people like Ida B. Wells or Harriet Tubman, for example. But one of the things about Sojourner Truth that caught my eye is the fact that she was very deliberate about using photography and the media in that way in order to promote the message that she was sending.
She was very aware of her public image.
Exactly. And I'm not saying that those other women aren't, but, you know, Nell Painter, she did some really excellent research on Sojourner Truth. And she, you know, it was her work on Sojourner Truth that got my attention. And I thought, well, you know, that's interesting because at that point she's managing her image in a way that I think Black women today are called to manage their image, particularly if they're in the public eye and if they're in the public eye in pursuit of a goal of social justice of some sort.
There is a photograph in the book of Sojourner Truth, and you point out how carefully she must have crafted that image and what she's doing. And in the photo, she is beautifully dressed and completely dressed. Skin of any kind showing. And she's an elderly woman, really, at this point. And she's sitting at a table, very demure-looking, knitting.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it's an image that many of us would look at and think, wow, there's Sojourner Truth, but we wouldn't go beyond that. What do you think was going through her mind when she selected the clothes and the location and the knitting?
Oh, that's wow. God, it would be a privilege to imagine that I could get into Sojourner Truth's mind, but let's think about it. I mean, at that time, and I think even now, Black women are confronted with this this feeling that they have to present themselves in a respectful way in order to combat the existing stereotypes that are out there. So if you think about slavery and the fact that African-American women, one of the ways that people justified slavery and the rape of African-American women was to argue that, in fact, they themselves were lusty and they threw themselves to their owners. And so in some ways they were responsible. And so I think that the image that we get with Sojourner Truth counters that, right? So you see a woman who is pious, who is modest, who in some ways I think there's sort of an argument behind that. I'm just like you, right? So to the women in the abolitionist movement where she'd go to speak to them, it's sort of like, see, I'm like you. I sit at home and knit and, you know, I'm not loose, so to speak. So.
And it's a very non-threatening image, although she was one woman of many people at the time who were trying to radically transform the United States of America.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, you know, the politics of respectability and the politics of representation is so important, right? So, and I think one of the things that I emphasize over and over again in the book is that when confronted with these images, Black women who are pursuing a revolutionary goal, and one of the things I do early in the book is define revolutionary Black woman as someone who's engaged in progressive or revolutionary politics for social change. So what they have to do, you know, when they set out on this goal is not only anticipate like how they'll be constructed and how that might negatively affect the campaign or whatever that they're pushing forward, but then thinking about what counter images, how can I resist and provide another construction of Black womanhood.
Let's go forward in time, and again, let's talk about this iconic image of an angry Black woman, and for many people, I think the iconic image of an angry Black woman that might come to mind is Angela Davis, and she was a brilliant professor
Still is.
Yes. but wound up on the FBI's 10 uh-huh. most wanted list. And with that sort of transformation, although it's not like she changed who she was, but there were all of these images of her that were everywhere. And you include many of them in the book of how she was portrayed in magazines and all over the place. What are we seeing in these images?
Well, you know, before I specifically answer that question, I want to talk a little bit about why I was drawn to images of Angela Davis. Yes. One of the things I started to see in the 90s, and I think even now, like if you go on the internet and you do a search of Angela Davis, what you see over and over again are images of her from the 60s and 70s, right? So it's like she's never aged. She's sort of caught in this moment.
Right, like where, 1969, 1970, and that's
exactly
freeze frame.
And then you see t-shirts with her image on them, right? And I went to a pop culture conference a few years ago, and there was this young woman with this huge afro, and she had Angela Davis right on her t-shirt. And I was thinking to myself, okay, it's important to understand how the image of Angela Davis functioned during the time when people were talking about her the most. That is, what were the discourses about Black womanhood, Black women in the Black Power movement, Black women and their relationship to feminism. So, you know, that's important. But then to also think about how those images take on a life of their own outside of their historical context and to really think about how women today or even consumers today are utilizing that image. And, you know, what can that tell us about Black women and how we perceive them in American culture?
The images in 1969, in 1970, that we see of Angela Davis, many of them come from her speaking publicly and rallying people to her cause for mm-hmm. social justice. And she's got her mouth open and she does look angry.
Well, you
or
know,
at least powerful.
Well, yeah. And the reality is many of the people during that time were angry and had reason to be angry. So the question becomes, how is that anger different than the anger of any other American citizen, right? And then how does the anger of a particular group of people, how is that portrayed, right? And how does that become sort of the archetype of an entire group, you know? So I'm sure she was angry about some things. In other situations, I'm sure she was just being a strong, assertive woman, and that was interpreted as anger.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment. My guest is Lakeisha Johnson. She's a professor at Grinnell College, and her latest book is Iconic, Decoding Images of the Revolutionary Black Woman. We'd love to have you join our conversation as well. How do you see Black women being portrayed in media today? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Lakeisha Johnson. She is an assistant professor of gender, women's and sexuality studies and English at Grinnell College. Her book, latest book, is Iconic, Decoding Images of the Revolutionary Black Woman. And we've been talking about some of the different stereotypes that you see put onto Black women in media, in popular culture over the years. And we're talking most recently about the iconic image of an angry Black woman. And we were talking about Angela Davis, who, of course, found herself on the FBI's most wanted list back in the 1970s and spent some time in prison before being acquitted. And one of the very interesting things in the articles that you put in your book and the images that we see is the focus in these articles on the fact that Angela Davis is such a beautiful woman?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the media coverage, there are these moments in the photographs, in the interviews or the text of the articles where there's a lot of focus on her beauty. This happens both in African-American magazines like Jet, as well as, you know, some of the larger magazines. And so one of the things that really intrigued me about this. It's like, what is this about? How can we sort of construct this woman as both dangerous, right, for the country, and as sort of the mastermind behind these dangerous black men, and then at the same time spend all of this time talking about, you know, her beauty, right? And, you know, I guess one of the things I argue is that this process of sexualization or objectification actually helps to ameliorate the threat that a woman like Angela Davis poses, right, to the status quo. So, you know, she's talking about, you know, the horrors of the prison industrial complex. She's challenging what some would hold dear in terms of American culture. And so this is a way to make it easier to deal with her, I think. I mean, that's part of what I argue.
There also seems to be this comparing of images early in her life and later when she was speaking out. It's sort of this disconnect between this beautiful young schoolgirl and the woman that she became, mm-hmm. and almost an inability to understand, how could this lovely young woman turn into this?
Exactly. And I think that, you know, undergirding that is not only the issue of race, we're talking about class as well. So, you know, you have this highly educated African-American woman from a pretty respectable family, you know, middle class, and suddenly she's on the FBI most wanted list. And I think in the popular imagination, there's this narrative that gets constructed, you know, good girl gone bad, right? And it's almost like, okay, this is our worst nightmare of what a black woman could turn into. I mean, again, we're talking about the construction of Angela Davis, not Angela Davis, the person.
Right. Tom is on the line from Fairfield. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What would you like to talk about?
I want to talk to this issue of anger. I was thinking about how, you know, Dr. King was shot in 1968, and he epitomized the patient, totally forgiving, extremely high level of spirituality, which just really got pushed over with Black Power. And when he was shot, it was sort of like, look, this can't work. And I'm looking at the inevitability of anger in any arising of anybody out of an oppressed class. And I lived through that period, but I haven't tracked exactly what Angela Davis did since then, but I think you were talking about making some reference to the phases that she lived with. You know, Beethoven had many phases. The Beatles had phases. Everybody has phases and develops. And but I really want to talk a little bit to that inevitability of anger coming out in the you know, I remember reading James Baldwin novels too at the time, and he was saying, I've got this anger that at any moment I could be walking down the street and just want to take the head right off somebody's shoulders. You know, this tremendous anger that comes out at times, but it's not a permanent state. I wonder if you can talk to those issues a little bit.
Well, Tom, we'll try to get to that a little bit. But I think obviously when you have a group of people who is oppressed, anger is an emotion that is going to bubble up and has throughout history and continues to bubble up and will continue to bubble up. But I think today we're talking about how taking these images of someone who may be angry and rightfully so, but using those images as a way to sort of undercut their credibility.
Absolutely. I would agree with you. And that's one of the key arguments of the book, that despite this persistent use of the angry black woman stereotype to undermine the, you know, strong black women and women who are pursuing, you know, the public good, not just for black people, but for all Americans in some ways, that despite that black women have learned how to negotiate that space and to utilize some of those images to transform, you know, the construction of black womanhood that's that's being placed upon them.
Well, and of course, we're talking about Angela Davis, and we're talking about 1969, 1970, and the Black Panther movement, and a period of time when there was a lot of conflict. But it is an image that comes back today, mm-hmm. over and over again. And in your book, you cite an example, and this is during the presidential campaign of 2008, when Larry King sat down with Michelle Obama, the future first lady. And in that interview, he repeatedly asks her questions and uses the term, "Aren't you angry about that?" And he brings it up over and over again. And let's play just a moment from that interview, which went on for quite some time. And you cite many examples like this in the book. But let's listen to a little bit of it.
If someone calls, who's running for vice mm-hmm. president, that your husband associates mm-hmm. with terrorists, mm-hmm. God upset you, I would think.
You know, that's part of politics. But
it doesn't, it goes right over you?
You know, these issues have come up before. But what the one thing that I'm proud about with Barack is that one of the things he's been talking about is our tone. And it's the notion that he says we can disagree without being disagreeable. And that's, you know, where he's trying to get to in this campaign, the notion that we can disagree on some fundamental issues in this country, but we have to do it without demonizing one another, without labeling one another, because we're in some tough times now. And what we can see from the fall of this economy is that when we fall, we all fall. And when we rise, we all rise. And whether we're Republicans or Democrats or independents or black or white or straight or gay, that we're in this together, and that there are times that we will disagree, that we won't share the same policies, but we're going to rise and fall together. And that's the tone that I like. And I think that's where Americans want their elected officials to be.
So that's just a moment from that Larry King interview with Michelle Obama. And that was just one question. But there were many questions that were very similar to that. Lakeisha, when you watch that interview, when you hear these questions, what are you seeing happening?
Let's see. First, I see the media being the media. And again, no offense, Charity, but anyway. I mean, there's something exciting about sort of wanting to imagine Sarah Palin and Michelle Obama in a fight over what you said this about my husband, right? Like the cat fight. So in some ways, I think that it's tempting for a media person to jump on that, right? However, when she obviously made it clear that not only had she not read about the interview or heard about the interview, I mean, you know, he actually goes and plays it for her. You know, and so he's sort of baiting her, right? He's waiting to get a rise out of her. And what's so beautiful and exciting about what Michelle Obama does is she manages to keep her composure, which she always does in public. I don't know what she's like at home, but anyway. But she keeps her composure and she redirects the attention to the important things. That is, our campaign is about the American people, right? It's not about being angry. It's not about Sarah Palin being bad and me being good. And in fact, she compliments Sarah Palin in that interview.
She talks about the fact that here is a working mom who's mm-hmm. demonstrating publicly mm-hmm. how she has to juggle her different roles, which most of us do privately.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that Mrs. Obama is doing in that moment is she's crafting an image of herself as somebody who works with people, not against them, a person who, while they may not like what you say or they may disagree with what you say, that they're not going to be disagreeable, that they're not combative. So
it's exactly what Sojourner Truth was doing with that photograph.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And actually, if you think about what was at stake during that time in terms of the end of abolition, I mean, there were all of these horror stories out there being promoted by white supremacists who basically said, you know, if we end slavery, you know, the blacks are going to get us, they're going to kill, you know. So there's this image of the dangerous African-American person, right? And black women were not immune from that. And so to see Sojourner Truth sitting in her, you know, her in her room with, you know, her knitting gives a counter image. So really we're talking about point counterpoint here, gives a counter image that says, well, you may be worried about what's going to happen, but, you know, we just want our freedom and we're just like you. We're human beings. We deserve equality.
And fast forward to 2008, Larry King was not the only person in the media who tried to, and not necessarily that he was trying to portray Michelle Obama mm-hmm. as an angry woman, but to try to touch a nerve mm-hmm. with her. There were other people who more blatantly portrayed Michelle Obama as an angry black woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, opponents of her husband's campaign jumped on the incident that, well, it wasn't really an incident. I mean, she gave a speech and she talked about for the first time being proud to be an American, really proud to be an American. And that was twisted into, well, she's unpatriotic, right? And so therefore she's bad for the nation. And again, these were people who were against the campaign. And so what I'm most interested in this book is how do representations that sort of float out there in the atmosphere, how do we grab onto those at these moments, right? And insert them into a conversation where they're inappropriate or, you know, where they just don't make sense, right? Or where they actually cause us to take the conversation into another direction.
Shanna is on the line from North Liberty. Hi, Shanna.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, what's your question?
My question, well, Professor Johnson, I just want to let you know that I'm really looking forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
And my question is, why does the public fear the anger of black women? During the course of the conversation, you've talked about the right to be angry. And if black folk have a right to be angry, how do you think the suppression of this anger sort of extends the oppression of black people in general and black women in particular?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Wow, how does it extend the oppression? I mean, I think whenever you're forced to be silent about who you really are and how you really feel, that's a weapon that's used in an oppressive situation. And so if African-Americans are forced to believe that there's something wrong with, you know, being uncomfortable or being upset about being in an oppressive system, then some of those African-Americans will think that they don't have a legitimate gripe, right? That they don't have a legitimate claim against whoever it is that's oppressing them at the moment, right? And so, you know, on the one hand, while there are plenty of African-Americans who aren't necessarily, quote unquote, angry in the negative sense, they do have a right to be angry about injustice and to move forward to fight against that. And I think that's where the women in this book, or particularly we're talking about Michelle Obama, how she redirects the situation or the conversation.
Well, in talking about the public image that Michelle Obama has crafted, you know, obviously we all craft public images.
Sure we do.
We all have throughout time. Most of us are a slightly different version of ourselves at work than we are at home. So I'm not trying to indicate that there's any kind of artifice or mm-hmm. or pretending to be somebody that she's not in doing that. But, I mean, she has carefully chosen this image to do a number of different things, I think, for her and for her husband. What do you see her doing? What is she trying to portray herself as? And what do you think her motives are?
I can't say what her motives are, but I can definitely tell you that she's crafted an image of herself as an ideal mother and wife, not just nurturer of her family, but in some ways nurturer of the nation, right? Now, some might argue that takes us back to that sort of domesticated Black woman, right? I mean, one could argue that you can't really ignore the fact that Mammy's still out there, right? Not Michelle Obama, but that the idea of the nurturing Black woman is out there, okay? Other people, and, you know, I would agree with this as well, I think both of these things are going at the same time. She's also claiming a space for Black women to be seen as strong mothers and partners, right? So, you know, you have this image of the welfare queen who's, you know, sitting around with five children, you know, no father, who's getting paid by the government to sit on her rear. And then you see this very public example of Black motherhood, right, that says, you know, we're not bad mothers. We deserve to be respected as caretakers of our families. So, I mean, I think both, you know, in her construction of herself as wife and mother for the nation, she's negotiating those two images, right? And I don't think that she's necessarily sitting around saying this, but the reality is, if when you look at her response to different things that people say about her, you see this negotiation happening.
And we'll talk about some of the other facets of her public image and the public images of many African-American women in a moment. My guest is Lakeisha Johnson. She's an assistant professor at Grinnell College. Her most recent book is Iconic: Decoding Images of the Revolutionary Black Woman. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Lakeisha Johnson. She's an assistant professor of gender, women's and sexuality studies and English at Grinnell College. We're talking today about her book, Iconic: Decoding Images of the Revolutionary Black Woman. And we've been talking about Michelle Obama, our first lady. And we went back to talking about how in the 2008 campaign, there were people who tried to portray her as an angry Black woman because she's a strong Black woman. And we were talking just before the break about how she has worked to portray herself as an ideal mother and an ideal partner in her domestic situation. But when you look back at other first ladies, she has also been, in many ways, I think, more active professionally than many other first ladies in choosing, and I guess that's not necessarily a fair comparison. Now I'm thinking of some other first
some
ladies
other ones
who have really worked professionally in their roles as first ladies. But she has certainly not backed down. You know, she is out there in the public speaking, talking about what's important to her, and she has certainly made a decision to demonstrate that side of herself as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I say that she's negotiating, you know, these two, Patricia Hill Collins calls it controlling images. So she's stuck between, you know, these two images of Black women, right? I'm not suggesting that she's not being authentically Michelle Obama. I think what she's doing is emphasizing an aspect of herself that in many ways is more palpable to a larger group of American people. That in fact, the professional Michelle Obama, who's a lawyer, who was a mentor to our president, you know, all of these things, right? And I'm sure they're still true about her. Those things take a back seat in the public representation of Michelle Obama. And that, again, I don't think she's sitting around saying, okay, let me, you know, present an image that's not me, because I believe she's authentically representing part of who she is. When Jodi Kantor's book, The Obamas, was released in January, and, you know, this idea of the angry Black woman reemerged, right? Because, I mean, and again, this is after Michelle Obama has, quote unquote, proved herself to be very patriotic and very committed to America, not just Black America, not, you know, America. You know, she's confronted with this image again, and she says to Gayle King, and I'll just, you know, read this quote that she says to Gayle King in this interview, because I think that it sums up what many of these African-American women in the public eye are asking for. And she says, you know, I just try to be me. And my hope is that over time people get to know me and they get to judge me for me. Right. And so one of the things that I think undergirds this whole situation for Black women is that we are living our lives, being who we are, and that authentic person, you know, that person who's vulnerable, that person who's strong, that person who gets angry, that person who laughs and has joy for life, she gets obscured by the negative images, right? And so at any moment as you go through and you're living your life, she could hit you in the head, right? You know, you can be faced with that and realize that someone's judging you based on that and not on who you really are.
I want to talk about hair.
Sure.
And it seems like a ridiculously trivial thing to talk about, but hair is something that in images of Black women plays, it seems to me, a very important role. And we look at these images of Angela Davis with her afro. You know, her hair is completely natural and it's big. We look at images of Michelle Obama and, you know, her hair is straight, very much tamed. In fact, I think Oprah Winfrey appeared on the cover of her magazine mm-hmm. for the very first time with her natural hair and in years, you know, and Oprah Winfrey, probably the most well-known, most recognizable Black woman, definitely in America, perhaps worldwide, maybe even more recognizable than our first lady. And that's a pretty bold statement in 2012, isn't it?
Unfortunately, yeah. You know, it's like, what? Since when is wearing your hair the way it comes out of your head radical? Well, when it comes to Black women, if you go back and look at the historical context, right, if you look at the fact that, you know, the wearing of one's natural hair, the wearing of the afro was seen as a way to embrace being Black in America, especially when you're confronted with images that tell you that you're not valuable, that you're not beautiful. And that became associated with a very radicalized movement, right? And so I think the afro will forever be, I think, associated with that period. And when a Black woman chooses to wear her hair in its natural state, there's going to be a reference to that, even if she's not thinking about that. So it's like, again, one of the things I keep saying over and over again is that these images and these representations, these discourses about people of color and Black women in particular are out there, right? And they reinforce notions about Black womanhood that may or may not be true, right?
So when a Black woman in 2012 decides how she wants to style her hair, that's a political statement?
For some Black women, it could be. For many, it's not, right? But the reality that the politics of hair is alive and well, you know, in 2012 is definitely the case. I mean, we can't ignore the fact that untamed hair is associated with a woman who is untamable, right? So there's this connection that's being made between wild hair and a potential threat, right? I'm thinking about the case with Cynthia McKinney, where she has a confrontation with one of the security guards in Congress because he doesn't recognize her because she has her hair out. And they get into this confrontation because he wants to see her badge. But when her hair's, you know, back in a bun, there's no question about it. And there's this whole construction of Cynthia McKinney as this angry Black woman. And there's this association with the hair, right? So
I think a couple of weeks ago, maybe it was Slate magazine, an artist actually drew a picture of what they think Michelle Obama would look like if she wore her hair naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And the subtext was, America is not ready. So, which I found to be a little bit shocking, but it certainly made me ask the question, is America ready to have a first lady who could wear her hair as it naturally curls?
I don't think so. Honestly, I don't think so. If you look back to the New Yorker cover, and that was, you know, really interesting because Michelle Obama does not wear her hair in an afro.
Right. And again, this was back in two. Was that before the election? Mm-hmm. Or after? It was before mm-hmm. the election, and it's a picture, and it's a obviously a drawing, an illustration uh-huh. of the Obamas looking like radicals.
Yeah, yeah,
and fist pumping.
Exactly. And the thing that's so funny about that is that that's not Michelle Obama. But it was so easy for the artists to grab the afro and the fatigues and the combat boots and to bring us back to a time when the dangerous radical black woman was a threat to America. And so, again, that sort of shows how those images can be so powerful and how they can be utilized at any moment to evoke a particular type of black woman.
Over the past week and a half, the entire world has been watching a very strong young black woman with Iowa ties. We are all proud and yeah. proud to say. We've all been watching Gabby Douglas win her 2 gold medals. And, you know, most of the world is admiring and witnessing her spunk and her fortitude and her amazing calm under all of this pressure. And then people start talking about her hair. What was your reaction when you started hearing people criticizing Gabby Douglas for how she was wearing her hair while performing these amazing feats of skill and strength?
Well, I think it's outrageous that anyone would focus on her hair when she's doing these incredible things, you know, with her body. And I also find it really problematic that women in sports in general, right, have to worry about sort of how they look, you know. So there's that critique going on. I mean, I think women in the media generally. But then, you take this young African-American young woman and she's a champion, right? So how do you cut her down, right? And I really don't know the motivations of some of the people who criticized her for her hair, but it doesn't really surprise me that a young woman is scrutinized. However, I do think the way that young black female athletes are scrutinized about their hair tells us a little something about how racism works. I mean, and again, I'm thinking of Serena and Venus Williams. When they first came on the scene, they used to wear their hair in cornrows and beads. And all of a sudden, there was this big, you know, hoopla about, oh, no, you know, this is dangerous. I don't know. They'll fall out. You know, it became an issue, right? Whereas, you know, no one said, oh, look at that girl over there. She has a ponytail. Like, so why is it that a style that's associated with black people or an African or Afrocentric way of expressing oneself, why is that a problem? With Gabby, I mean, she's not wearing an afro, but I do think in those comments about her hair, there was the sentiment that she needed to take more time with her hair, that she needed to make sure that her hair was straight and in place and, you know, all of those things. And I think part of that goes back to this idealized view of what's beautiful, you know, straight, long hair, blonde hair, blue eyes, you know, being thin, you know, all of these things that women are confronted with all the time in our media.
So on one hand, I mean, we are watching the first African-American woman to win both the all-around and the team gold medal mm-hmm. in gymnastics in the Olympic Games. And that is an amazing moment to look at a sport that is predominantly dominated by white women, white girls. Mm-hmm. And also we see a young woman who does not come from a privileged background mm-hmm. who her mother, her family has sacrificed a great deal to get her where she is. So there's another stereotype broken. And then the conversation turns to her hair. Do you feel like that moment for African-American women was tarnished by this distraction?
No. You know, I think that, and again, this goes back to what I talk about in the book. I think that because of the world that we live in, because of the way Americans are taught to view Black women, many of us have gotten used to these moments. Like, it's sort of like you're playing a record and then all of a sudden it scratches and you're like, okay, I have to start the song over. And you resist that, right? And it might bother you. You might be irritated. But you can't let that steal your joy, right? And so I feel like, you know, the women in my book, despite the things that people tried to throw at them, they were able to say, look, I have a goal, I have a purpose, and you can call me whatever you want. You can talk about Black people and Black women, but this is my agenda. This is my goal. And that's the most important thing.
When Barack Obama was elected, a lot of people started talking about a post-racial America. Clearly we're having this conversation, so we haven't quite gotten there yet. But do you see progress being made in how the media is portraying Black women today as opposed to even 10 years ago?
What I see is more images of Black women. The question is, how diverse are those images and do they accurately represent the wide range of experiences that Black women have, right? And the reality is they don't. You know, I mean, if you think about reality television, you know, if you only watched, if an alien was watching reality television and wanted to know what Black women were like, I think they'd be afraid,
but
right?
They wouldn't have a very good image of our culture as a whole.
Well, that's
anyway.
True. You're absolutely right about that. I mean, that's the problem with reality television, but I do think, you know, the angry Black woman who wants to fight and who's, you know, in your face is alive and well in reality television. And there's a certain sort of mandate, like people expect it. And so I think that many of these young women who go on these shows are actually, they feel compelled to do that, right? That doesn't mean that they're not really, you know, again, it's not that there isn't a part of themselves that's being displayed. What I'm saying is there's something about the industry that makes that image.
It's an archetype that continues to come back.
More lucrative, too.
And makes good TV, apparently.
Exactly. And it's lucrative. Now, again, there are lots of people getting rich and not the women who are on these shows. So I don't know. That's a tough one.
How about in other arenas, though? I mean, in the news media, do you feel like with the Obamas in the White House that strides have been made in how African-American people are being covered?
Ooh, depends on who you're talking about, like what media outlet you're talking about. But yeah, I think that there are enough really positive images of African-American people, and there actually have always been really positive images, examples of African-American people in our culture. The question is, who gets the time? You know, are you more likely to see, you know, an African-American person being cuffed and put in a squad car versus an African-American who's, you know, in her community, you know, being a mentor for young girls? You know, so I think that that's definitely something that the media can work on, because we're out here.
Right. And it persists. Lakeisha Johnson, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Lakeisha Johnson is an assistant professor at Grinnell College. Her most recent book is Iconic: Decoding Images of the Revolutionary Black Woman. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.